the science of vaccines and COVID-19, the science of climate. And we're seeing the defunding of research in this area. We're seeing researchers attacked and vilified and threatened because of the research that they do, because it's inconvenient, again, to certain ideological interests who want to see us double down on fossil fuels, or who have bought into the idea that, you know, vaccines are a dangerous conspiracy. In both cases, the consequences are deadly. People are losing their lives, and many more people will lose their lives if we continue down this current path of anti-science that we're going down here in the United States. It's a very dangerous time for all of us. And, you know, the irony here is that this is a country that was built on science and technology. And the wonders of, you know, modern life are due to the fact that this country valued scientists and it promoted and supported scientists for decades. And now, because certain areas of science have become inconvenient, again, to certain ideologically driven individuals and groups and industries, we find science under an attack. You know, again, there's almost no precedent. You have to go back to, you know, the early 1900s, Stalin's Russia, you know, the assault on scientists that happened then.
Michael Mann, we have to leave it there. I want to thank you for being with us from the University of Pennsylvania. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
I'm Doug McVeigh, host of Free Culture Radio. Every month, we bring you 30 minutes of news and information about people who use drugs, as we discuss topics like safe supply, safe consumption spaces, decriminalization, legalization, harm reduction, human rights, civil rights, and much more. Tune in and listen to Free Culture Radio on the third Wednesday of each month from 6:30 to 7 p.m. Pacific here on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon legislature designated nearly $140 million towards a new theater at PSU. Trump's big bill has passed the Senate with revisions, and it's now going back to the House for a final vote. And Trump's strike on Iran is being investigated. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 1st, 2025. I'm Eric Leuschner. People who are seeking asylum status in the U.S. are being arrested during mandatory ICE check-ins. A man going by the pseudonym Jorge was living in Portland with a family and a functional work visa. He received a text from ICE ordering him to go in for a mandatory court check-in and sign paperwork or face deportation. When he received the text, he consulted a lawyer about what the correct plan of action was. The lawyer advised him to go to the court date, but he was nonetheless detained. He has been in the Tacoma Detention Center for almost a month already and still doesn't have any information about when he might be released. Attorneys with Equity Corp of Oregon confirmed that this has been happening to other asylum seekers as well. Jorge's attorney expects that he will probably not be released for at least 6 months while he waits for his court date for appealing for asylum. Some local community orgs are organizing efforts to escort asylum seekers to their court dates so that they have more support in case ICE attempts to detain them. This story references in-depth reporting by Courtney Vaughn, published by the Portland Mercury. The Oregon legislature approved almost $140 million in state bonds for a new arts center at PSU, Portland State University will be getting a new 1,200-seat theater, academic space, and a parking lot. It is part of a plan to create venues capable of hosting Broadway shows. This combines with PSU's plan to renovate the century-old Keller Auditorium. Tentative plans are for construction on the new PSU Theater to begin in 2027 and to finish for an opening in 2030. The PSU Theater will host performances while the Keller Auditorium is under construction. The Keller will reopen in 2031 if all goes as planned. Republican Tom Tillis denounces Medicaid cuts in Senate bill over White House objections. NGOs say New York work requirements for people in SNAP and Medicaid don't reflect reality, and President Trump says trade talks with Canada will restart. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This bill, in its current form, will betray the very promise that Donald J. Trump made in the Oval Office or in the cabinet room when I was there with finance, where he said we can go after waste, fraud, and abuse on any program.
North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis was one of two Republicans to join Democrats in voting against advancing the budget reconciliation mega bill. Speaking from the Senate floor, he said in spite of White House assurances, his independent investigation found it would cost nearly 750,000 people in North Carolina their health coverage. The bill would cut almost $800 billion from Medicaid nationwide, taking 14 million people out of the program. Tillis's vote is one of his last since he says he won't be seeking re-election. The White House was quick to counter the Republican stalwart's comments. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt says Tillis is just wrong about the bill's impacts.
It ensures able-bodied Americans who can work 20 hours a week are actually doing so, and that will therefore strengthen and protect those benefits for Americans who need it, cutting out the waste, fraud, and abuse, as well as getting 1.4 million illegal aliens off of the program.
But people who work with Medicaid or SNAP recipients say proposed work requirements are out of touch with reality. The bill would require proof of employment, volunteering, or school up to age 64, limit waivers for areas with high unemployment, and end many exemptions. But Vince Hall with Feeding America says almost everyone on these programs who can work is employed or looking for a job. In fact, they often have a second or third job.
The bad news is their wages, even with sometimes two full-time jobs, are so insufficient that despite how hard they are working, they are still unable to afford the basics of rent, food, and health care.
Cases of fraud and SNAP have grown in the last year, but still represent about 1.7% of transactions. And critics of the legislation argue the bill would do nothing to address the real problems, most often card skimmers or other point-of-sale theft. Responding to the budget bill, Georgia Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock calls it reverse Robin Hood, stealing from the poor to give to the rich.
I submit that a budget is not just a fiscal document. A budget is a moral document. Show me your budget and I'll show you who you think matters and who doesn't.
Budget watchdogs say the bill, as revised, would add $3.3 trillion to the national debt. Meanwhile, Canada is rescinding a proposed digital services tax on American tech firms, which had been set to take effect Monday. President Donald Trump had threatened to end all trade talks with the country. He says the U.S. relationship with Canada has been difficult, noting the country was foolish to implement this tax.
Economically, we have such power over Canada. I'd rather not use it, but they did something with our tech companies today, trying to copy Europe. You know, they copied Europe. It's not going to work out well for Europe either, and it's not going to work out well for Canada.
He says the 3% tax would have a severe impact on businesses, including Amazon, Google, and Meta, even though it would represent only a tiny part of their operating revenues. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report with Lisa Loving. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be a high of 89 degrees and a low of 56 degrees. And tomorrow will be a high of 79 and a low of 56. Today in history, rapper and producer Missy Elliott was born. The quote of the day is from Mark Twain, who said, quote, "The best way to cheer yourself up is to cheer somebody else up." A federal audit has found that the Environmental Protection Agency did not distribute millions of dollars on time to clean water programs for tribes. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A federal audit has found that the Environmental Protection Agency did not distribute millions of dollars on time to clean water programs for tribes. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel reports, this comes as tens of thousands of tribal homes lack indoor plumbing and clean drinking water.
The agency's own inspector general examined more than $300 million from the bipartisan infrastructure law that was supposed to go to tribal water programs over 2 years. In the 2022 fiscal year, more than half of the funds allocated had not been awarded on time. And in 2023, most of the remaining water project funds did not get distributed. The audit cited that the Indian Health Service estimates about 41,000 tribal homes lack indoor plumbing, and thousands lack access to safe drinking water.
So these funds are really tailored to addressing those problems. Funds for designing and constructing wastewater treatment facilities, improving drinking water systems, and addressing emerging contaminants.
That's Marcus Gullett with the Inspector General's office. The EPA acknowledged in a final report that it made mistakes in most cases and said it would work to fix them. It agreed to focus on improving the timeliness of providing funds to tribes. I'm Caleb Radel.
Navajo Nation leaders are urging residents near the Oak Ridge Fire to remain vigilant and follow emergency protocols and evacuation alerts. The fire is burning on the reservation near St. Michael's, Arizona. Residents in at least three communities were evacuated on Sunday. As of Tuesday morning, the fire was at more than 9,000 acres with zero containment. More than 150 people recently gathered in America's northernmost community for the Migratory Bird Festival. KNBA's Alaska Desk reporter Ayolna Naiden has more on the festival and the rapid growth of birding tourism in Alaska.
A little brown bird walks and chirps along the still partially frozen Utqajevik Lagoon. It's a semi-palmated sandpiper, one of about 60 species that locals and visitors spotted during the Migratory Bird Festival. Lindsay Hermans is the festival's coordinator. She says avid birders often travel to the Arctic to see rare species that fly here from all corners of the world. But sometimes it's even more exciting to see familiar birds in their breeding grounds, where they wear totally different plumage.
It's like a glow up. They look totally different. They're flying around. They're doing their mating displays and exhibiting this behavior that you only see in the Arctic.
Attendees rode around in school buses for several hours, spotting different birds and talking about Inupiaq culture, Utqajevik's history, and the Arctic environment. Herman says that the main goal of the free 3-day festival was to show how important the Arctic ecosystem is for the birds. But the highlight for her was what the participants brought to the table. Several elders came to the talks and commented on what birds they harvest, how they do it traditionally, and what they call those species in Inupiaq language.
That was a major component of success in my mind, is having the elders be involved like that.
Local knowledge holders and Inupiaq speakers also participated in creating new Utqajevik Birding Trail, a brochure that spotlights 10 sites throughout town where you can see birds in breeding plumage. As the Arctic warms, forests shrink, and hurricanes intensify, migrating to the Arctic becomes more difficult. This is Lauren Kusimana with Audubon Alaska.
Utqajevik becomes even more important for shorebird species because once they get there, they can do their thing.
Herman says she hopes more Arctic residents will get involved in organizing the event in the future. I am Alona Naiden.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
After an all-night session, the U.S. Senate passed the Trump administration's tax and spending bill back to the House. The so-called Big Beautiful Bill, which Portland Mercury has dubbed the Big Beautiful Lie, would slash taxes for the wealthy, reduce social safety net programs, and engorge funding for the military and immigration enforcement spending, all while adding over $3 trillion to national debt. Vice President J.D. Vance broke the Senate's 50-50 vote to pass the bill. The measure would cut about $930 billion from Medicaid and food aid for low-income Americans and slash most of Biden's green energy initiatives. Some revisions were made to the bill, despite Speaker Mike Johnson's warning not to touch the bill in order to pass it quickly. Two revisions which were key to securing some of the final Republican votes are provisions to send more food aid to some states, including Alaska, and $50 billion to rural hospitals to help cope with the cuts. Trump wants to pass the bill by the 4th of July. The House vote is expected to also be close. The recent divorce between billionaire Elon Musk and Donald Trump is getting even more contentious. Musk is claiming he may form a new political party, and Trump has attacked the Tesla CEO over electric vehicle subsidies. The most prominent divide between them is Trump's big bill legislation. Musk ramped up his criticism of the bill over the last 3 days, arguing passing it would kill jobs and significantly slow down burgeoning industries. Musk posted on X over the weekend that the bill would be, quote, political suicide for the Republican Party. He also suggested he would work to get members of Congress who vote for the bill out of their seats next year. Musk wrote, quote, every member of Congress who campaigned on reducing government spending and then immediately voted for the biggest debt increase in history should hang their head in shame. They will lose their primary next year if it's the last thing I do on this earth, end quote. A few hours later, Musk posted a claim he will create a new political party if the bill passes. He wrote, quote, if this insane spending bill passes, the America Party will be formed the next day. Our country needs an alternative to the Democrat-Republican uniparty so that the people actually have a voice. That post about the America Party was viewed 32 million times. Trump fought back today, posting on Truth Social, quote, Elon may get more subsidy than any human being in history by far, and without subsidies, Elon would probably have to close up shop and head back home to South Africa, end quote. Trump threatened, quote, no more rocket launches, satellites, or electric car production, and our country would save a fortune. Perhaps we should have Doge take a good hard look at this. Big money to be saved, end quote. The president also warned Musk that the Department of Government Efficiency, or Doge, which the billionaire used to lead, could be his downfall. Trump said, quote, Doge could be the monster that turns around and eats Elon, end quote. The U.S. Supreme Court has decided to take up a case that challenges limits on super PACs' ability to coordinate with candidates for federal office, including the presidency and California's congressional delegation. Suzanne Potter has more on the story.
Good government groups are warning of big changes to the way federal campaigns are financed after the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to hear a case initially brought by Vice President J.D. Vance and Republican fundraisers. The case would affect campaigns for the presidency as well as the House and Senate from every state, including California. Hillary Brazeth with the nonprofit Open Secrets says right now there are limits on how political parties spend campaign cash, which is why billions in undisclosed dark money currently flows to super PACs.
What we might end up seeing is more donors now giving large sums of money directly to the parties and being able to coordinate directly with them in spending for that candidate for federal office.
The plaintiffs argue that campaign donations are legally considered free speech, and so current limits on the way it can be spent are unconstitutional. Right now, parties can accept millions, but cannot coordinate directly with the candidates' campaigns. Critics say the current rules are supposed to limit the possibility of a quid pro quo, where donors are rewarded with official action once a candidate takes office. Brazeth says this case could test the country's system of accountability to preserve free and fair elections.
The one thing that both Democrats and Republicans can agree on is that there's too much money in politics. It's clear that there's a growing resentment on behalf of the public and a vast majority of folks for the amount of money.
In this past presidential election, Elon Musk spent $277 million to back President Donald Trump and was later given control of the Department of Government Efficiency. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
It is now apparent that President Trump's claims that Iran's nuclear sites were obliterated is incorrect. Two conclusions stand out in the aftermath of the U.S. attacks. Iran still has the resources to build a nuclear weapon, and the administration defied the laws in carrying out a preemptive strike. Now for Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Portland State University, Mel Gertov, with the Global Citizen Commentary. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. President Trump sparked a national debate when he claimed that the results of the U.S. bombing of Iran's nuclear facilities was obliteration, with a very weak response. Since that finding of obliteration, other less grand assessments have been offered, ranging from enormous damage and severe damage to the Ayatollah Ali Khomeini's insistence that nothing at all was seriously damaged. Accompanying these assessments of what bombing accomplished are wide-ranging predictions of how badly Iran's nuclear program has been set back. A few months, several years? All these assessments and predictions obscure a simple fact. Iran still has the human and technical resources to produce a nuclear weapon at some point in the future, and now with greater incentive than ever to do so. Several expert accounts note that the airstrikes sealed off the entrances to two of the three Iranian nuclear facilities, but did not collapse their underground buildings. The Defense Intelligence Agency's report, which cites a three-month setback for Iran, said that much of Iran's stockpile of enriched uranium was moved before the strikes, which destroyed little of the nuclear material. Iran may have moved some of that to secret locations. Other officials noted that the report found that the three nuclear sites, Fordo, Natanz, and Isfahan, had suffered moderate to severe damage, with the facility at Natanz damaged the most. Herbert Lin, a Stanford University research fellow, analyzed the U.S. attacks for the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists and underscored two key problems with the obliteration thesis. Quote, first, the U.S. bombed known nuclear facilities. If the Iranians had a secret undeclared facility, for example, for uranium enrichment, this attack did not touch it. Second, this attack appears to have been an attack on the Iranian facilities for the enrichment of uranium, and not on Iran's existing stockpiles of enriched uranium. If enriched uranium were located at Fordo or Isfahan, the trucks seen at these facilities before strikes on them could easily have removed that material. Moving materials is a generally easier task than moving delicate machinery, unquote. Trump has been angered by news reports that have raised questions about the extent of the damage to Iran's nuclear facilities. The White House spokeswoman, Caroline Leavitt, said, quote, the leaking of this alleged assessment is a clear attempt to demean President Trump and discredit the brave fighter pilots who conducted a perfectly executed mission to obliterate Iran's nuclear program. Now, failing to acknowledge that the nuclear sites were obliterated is to fail the administration's latest test of loyalty. Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence, failed the test and has tried to recover by citing new intelligence to support Trump's position. But several reporters have endured Trump's and Pete Hegseth's wrath for questioning their claims. Perhaps most importantly, the bombing of Iran has demonstrated anew the Trump administration's lawlessness. It acted like the George W. Bush administration when it launched the Gulf War and twisted intelligence to falsely claim an Iraqi weapons of mass destruction program. But at least Bush, after deploying troops, obtained authorization from Congress. Trump began by carrying out a preemptive strike on Iran without evidence that Iran had weaponized or was close to weaponizing its enriched uranium. Then the administration failed to consult with Congress and defied the War Powers Act. Now, questioning of Trump's assessment of the bombing has led the administration to limit intelligence sharing with congressional committees. To make the point, Tulsi Gabbard was not among the four administration officials who briefed Congress members on the bombing of Iran. John Ratcliffe, the CIA director, who has towed the line on the level of destruction of Iran's nuclear sites, replaced Gabbard. The U.S., Israel, and other countries should be worried now about Iran's reaction to being struck so devastatingly. As Herbert Lin concludes, quote, the technical challenges of destroying deeply buried sites, the possibility of relocated materials, the impossibility of destroying Iranian knowledge and expertise about uranium enrichment and weapons design, all suggest that this may be only a temporary setback for Iran, and any long-term solution will not lie in military-only approach. That last point is especially important. More bombing cannot end Israel's or the U.S.'s problem with Iran. Only negotiations can. Absent negotiations, Iran may withdraw from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, just as North Korea did in 2003. Second, it may kick out the nuclear inspectors. Third, Iran might conduct a nuclear test several months from now to demonstrate that its nuclear sites were not obliterated. And fourth, Iran may step up attacks on Israel by proxies in Yemen, Lebanon, and Iraq. When all is said and done, will the Trump-Netanyahu bombing strategy still be hailed by their supporters as a great success? I'm Mel Gartoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
And now for labor history in two. with Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1929. That was the day 1,800 streetcar drivers and motormen walked off the job at New Orleans Public Service. The Amalgamated Association of Street and Electric Railway Employees, Division 194, had been in contract negotiations for months. They demanded higher wages, a closed shop, and an end to arbitrary discharges. The company was looking to bust the Amalgamated with the creation of a company union. For the first few days, the strike was quiet. But then, on July 5th, the company brought in strikebreakers. 10,000 union members and their supporters gathered to stop scab service. The company attempted to run a lone streetcar down Canal Street. Immediately, it was pelted with bricks and stones. The scab driver bailed. Another four cars attempted to leave the car barn. Pitched battles raged for hours with police and scabs. Two union men were shot and killed by scabs, and hundreds more injured. Trade unions throughout the city threatened a general strike. The strike raged on for 2 months. Throughout the summer, trolleys were burned to the ground, tracks destroyed, switches cemented in place. As the weeks wore on, conditions became more desperate. That's when Clovis and Beanie Martin, former Division 194 conductors, decided to help out. They had since left public transit to open the Martin Brothers coffee stand and restaurant. They declared to their former union brothers, quote, "We are with you, heart and soul. We are with you till hell freezes over." They offered free supersized sandwiches for the poor boys. The strikers would eventually win some of their demands. The sandwiches would become a standard in New Orleans cuisine, better known as the po' boy.
The Arctic is getting louder, and whales are paying the price. Melting ice brings more ships and industrial activity, interfering with how whales communicate and behave. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Imagine you're a bowhead whale. You're bigger than a school bus and spend your time swimming in the Arctic. Perhaps you're more than a century old.
And so that means you remember a time when the only noise in the ocean, in your habitat, was coming from wind and sea ice and waves and the various clicks and whistles and songs that other wildlife make.
But Sam Davin of the World Wildlife Fund Canada says today the Arctic is no longer so quiet. It's filled with the drone of ship propellers and the blasts of air guns used in oil and gas exploration. For a whale, the noise is not just a matter of disturbing the peace.
It's harder for you to navigate. It's harder for you to communicate. It's harder for you to avoid danger.
Studies have shown that underwater noises can cause bowhead whales to swim closer to shore, reduce their calls, and alter their dive cycles. And the Arctic is getting even noisier. As the climate warms, Arctic sea ice is melting, which enables more ship traffic in the region. So Davin's organization advocates for governments to monitor and regulate underwater noise to help protect bowheads and other vulnerable animals.
Someday, recharging an electric vehicle may be as easy as going for a drive. Mandy Stapleford has more on the story with Good News, Good Planet.
Good news, good planet, good news.
It's time now for your good news for a good planet. Road to the future. Someday, recharging an electric vehicle may be as easy as going for a drive. That's the goal of a groundbreaking electrified road project underway in Sweden. They're building the world's first permanent electric road, transforming a 13-mile stretch of highway into a continuous charging station for EVs. Drivers will be able to charge their vehicle's batteries simply by driving over the electrified road, using three possible charging systems: overhead power lines, electric rails, or an inductive system, or some combination of those three to support even more types of transport. It's a game changer for electric vehicle long-distance travel, taking the hassle out of stopping to charge and massively reducing range anxiety. But there's an even bigger benefit. By combining home and dynamic road charging, EV battery sizes can be reduced by an impressive 70%. Construction is already underway along European Route E20, providing easy access to major cities like Stockholm, Gothenburg, and Malmo. Sweden plans to expand its electric road system by a whopping 1,900 miles by 2045, inspiring other countries to join them as they create the clean, green electric roads of our future. And this is Mandy from GoodNewsGoodPlanet.com.
This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 1st, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem. The producer is Hannah Francis, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Antonia Gonzalez, Mandy Stapleford, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and Rick Smith. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
We're speaking to Jonah Rubin. He's the campus organizer of Jewish Voice for Peace. Thanks for being with us, Jonah.
Thanks for having me.
A lot has happened over the past week with U.S.-Israeli relations and what has been announced as the bombing of Iran's nuclear sites. Let's start, though, with Jewish Voice for Peace. What do you do?
Yeah, so I am the senior manager for campus organizing at Jewish Voice for Peace. We are a large national organization with chapters across the United States and various cities. My piece of the pie is I organize our network of around 50 student chapters at colleges and